Morning. Still feels a little odd to be sitting in a chair here and with a lectern down here. It's all a little different than what. Still just recovering from an injury. I think it'll take a little time yet. Turns out that recovering from an injury at 53 is different than 22, as I remember. thank you for all your efforts in the session so far. I think it's fair to say that session requires steadfast effort. It's a courageous practice of session, practice of Zen. These long hours of upright sitting and a full schedule. Wayu Sensei mentioned about the. I had a moment where he said he could have been on a beach sipping an alcoholic beverage of his choice, and I'm like, what? I could. But then, you know, in my experience of sitting on the beach and drinking alcoholic drink, anything can get old after a little while. I spent some time in Kauai, which is. You've ever been there, some people will, some people won't. But, you know, quintessential, beautiful, kind of tropical island. I remember being there and going snorkeling. And it's like, you know, finding Nemo under the water. It's amazing. You see all of that. It's like, oh, it's amazing snorkeling and doing that the first day. And then the next day we were out at the beach and it's like, you want to go snorkeling? Sure. We went in, snorkeled again. And then on the third day it was like, we're going to go snorkeling. Do you want to... with the snorkeling, you know. Is there anything else to do here? No? Like, bored in paradise on day three, you know. So there's that. That's maybe a part of our human nature too, is this undercurrent or undertow of dukkha and dissatisfaction that is inherent in our human experience, in that human condition. I wanted to bring up a koan today from my well-worn at this point copy of the Book of Equanimity. This has the translation by Shishin Wick Roshi, one of my Zumi Roshi's Dharma heirs, a Dharma brother attention Roshi. He did a wonderful job with his... with the commentaries. I was also looking at the Book of Serenity, sometimes translated that way by Cleary, Dr. Cleary did. And that contains all of the notes and the capping phrases and more commentary by the original compiler, Tendo Wanchi and a couple of others in there that contribute. So a lot more in that translation. Interesting that, you know, in Tendo Wanchi, you put the Book of Equanimity together. Apparently the first copy that was made, which of course, you know, was an enormous amount of work in those days to produce a book. Like many koan collections, it was an amalgam or drawn together from existing collections, some from here, some from there, and then he wrote his pointers and verses for each. But the original one was lost, and he had a student who was a pretty high court official. This was in the Southern Song Dynasty, like early 13th century, somewhere around there. And he had his job, his posting, was to go to Mongolia and work at the court of Genghis Khan. And he was part of a group of Chinese, educated Chinese noblemen of that time who went there in order to help mitigate the harsh rule of the Mongols in China in that area, you know, which is like no small, that's a heck of a foreign policy posting, you know, you're going to go work with try and soften Genghis Khan a little bit. Like, imagine a typical work day. I just execute everybody. Yeah, we could do that, but maybe not execute everybody. So he had that foreign policy posting, and he actually apparently asked Tendo Wangchi to produce a copy of the Book of Equanimity that he could have, so that he could continue his Zen studies, which he did. And through that amazing happenstance and circumstance, it comes down to us today. That student had been had a Confucian upbringing, being like many of the educated people of those times. And so some of that is also in the Book of Equanimity. It's a lot more, you know, you see in some of these commentaries, they weave in a lot of the allegory and story that's drawn from all over the influences in China at that time, in Taoism, Confucianism, you know, not just Buddhism per se. And he wrote the Book of Equanimity and compiled it. And I'll often look at this book because, I love it very much. And I worked on this when I returned to, after a short time of returning to Yokoji. And so I remember it well. And often skip past over the first case because the first case can seem so straightforward and maybe difficult to even add anything to. But that's a case that I wanted to bring up today. So this is case one. The world-honored one ascends the platform. Preface to the assembly. Close the gate and snooze. That's how to treat a superior person. Reflection, abbreviation, and elaboration are used for middling and inferior ones. How can you stand for someone to ascend the high seat and scowl? If anyone around here doesn't agree, step forward. I have no doubts about him. Main case. Attention, one day the world honored one, that's the Buddha, one day the world honored one ascended the platform and took his seat. Manjushri struck the sounding post and said, when you realize the Dharma King's Dharma, the Dharma King's Dharma is just as is. At that, the world-honored one descended from the platform. Appreciatory verse. Do you see the true manner of the primal stage? Mother Nature goes on weaving warp and woof. The woven old brocade contains the images of spring. Nothing can be done about the spring gods outflowing. So our main case. Attention, one day the world-honored one ascended the platform and took his seat. Manjushri struck the sounding post and said, when you realize the Dharma King's Dharma, the Dharma King's Dharma is just as is. At that, the world-honored one descended from the platform. So perhaps on the surface, this appears very, very straightforward and an easier day for the Buddha than perhaps from usual. There's a couple of other koan cases that have this, something close to this approach. A little further into the Book of Equanimity, we have Yakusan, who's in our lineage, Yakusan Egan, being asked by the administrator monk, you haven't given a talk for a long time, you know, the monks are wondering, well, could you please give a talk? And he goes up and looks around and then closes the book and gets back down and leaves and says to the administrator monk, you have sutra teachers for sutras and meditation teachers for meditation. Why are you bothering this old monk? It brings something very, very human into it. Probably as an elder teacher, well used to giving talks and maybe well used to people really not picking things up or picking up the baton, so to speak. Who knows what his state of mind, his causes and conditions were at that time. But it was a teaching. remember Tenshin Roshi saying that Maizumi Roshi once was started to give a talk, and then somebody was muttering to somebody in the back, and he just folded up his book and his cloth, got up and left. And that was that was the Dharma talk for the day. That was for teaching. Okay, so sometimes, and what is a Dharma talk? Like in our practice, for myself in Sesshin, I really look forward to the Dharma talks. You know, you had a couple of days of trying to settle down, going through some initial barriers around kind of discomfort, pain, and wondering maybe you should have gone to that beach. And then you'll hear a wonderful Dharma talk, and there is the reminder, that's why I do this. You know, something will be pointed out. Something, there's a remembrance. That's often what a Dharma talk invites, is a remembrance. Right? We have this this conditioned view of the world. Everyone. Nobody escapes that. Nobody escapes their bias. Everybody has that conditioned view of the world, but often our conditioned view obscures the immediate, unconditioned reality of our life, of this life. Yeah, I wonder, like, what words can we use to describe that? The Dharma King's Dharma is just as is for those who realize it. It's just as is. That just as is just as is now. Always just as is. But it's often, it's covered up or obscured by our ideas, projections, opinions, and beliefs, and narrative around this just as is. The Buddha was clearly an extraordinary world teacher. I was reading recently around, you know, about meditation was very old tradition by the time the Buddha came along already. The earliest depictions of meditation about 5000 BCE. But then the earliest depictions of pretty much anything is about 5000 BCE. Right? That's the earliest, like the early Bronze Age. That's when communities first started really settling down. There was some agriculture. There was, started to form early societies around that time. And both in words and in art, meditation was depicted. 5000 BCE. So if you go to the time of the Buddha in 500 BCE, there's already 4,500 years of meditation practice in that area beforehand. That's longer in time from the Buddha than the Buddha is in time from us now. It's only 2,500 years away from us now. So a long tradition. And in that area of like the Ganges Valley in northern India, there were enormity of spiritual teachers and practices centered around meditation. That was the era that the Buddha was born and lived in. Said that his clan, the Shakya clan, you know, if you look on a map or an ancient map, then they're really up in the corner, again, right up against the mountains of northeastern India. But they'd come into northeastern India through the mountains. They were people who used two-wheeled chariots or two-wheeled carts to transport their goods or I'd like to think that maybe the elderly got a ride too. Maybe they didn't. Depends on the culture, right? But they would drag these carts and chariots. So imagine bringing those through the Himalayas or through the foothills of the Himalayas. So you see the root word of dukkha, when it says it literally means a stuck axle wheel of an axle with a wheel with a bad axle. That's the root of this word dukkha. They were very familiar with what that really meant. Imagine you're pulling your life's possessions and everything that your family relies upon, and your wheel doesn't turn right. That's a major, major pain, a major frustration. And so that's the root of the word dukkha. And when they came into living in that area of northern India, they entered a world where there was a very rigid stratified caste system in the Hindu tradition of the day. And apparently the Shakyas were a little on the outs or distrusted in that system because they still had the practices of tree worship and snake worship. Right? You see this in Buddhist iconography. If you look back, you see sometimes a Buddha's depicted with a cobra behind him, on the throne. And you see references to the Naga King in some of the writings. Yeah. It's like old snake, some old traditions there, you know. If you wanted to start up a tree and snake worship religion, this would be a good place because right. We've still got a lot of trees and the snakes are now just coming out. But, you know, rattlers are best appreciated at a distance. So don't get too close to them. So coming from that, you know, it's fascinating. Coming into this caste system, a rigid way of understanding the world, the Buddha was truly an activist and truly led a rebellion against the standard dogmatic practices of the day. Yes. An extraordinary person. And yet what he built in terms of his way of teaching is drawn from the actual experience of the real as experienced by a human being. Not relying on philosophies or ideas around the world, but based on actual human experience of this life. Right? So Buddhism in that sense is an extraordinarily clear lens for looking at the fact of dukkha, the fact of how we suffer, and through illuminating that, finding ways to alleviate dukkha and suffering, to let go of unnecessary suffering. Because it turns out that most of our suffering as a human being is actually unnecessary. It's added by our upside down view, what the Buddha called upside down view. You know, we've spent most of the week sitting in glorious spring weather in the mountains of Southern California, blessed with blue skies, bird song. And yet, within those extraordinarily beneficial causes and conditions, have you at some point found yourself suffering? Right? As a human being, yes. Right? We usually can find some fault and find some difficulty. So in our koan, it begins with the Buddha doing what the Buddha does, which is going to give a talk that day to the community, tradition which has been upheld and maintained these many centuries. Somebody comes into the teaching seat and shares some words in an effort to help catalyze each person's own realization. Because the Dharma isn't something that's taught or given from one to another. It's not something that can be shared in that way. Each one of us has to do the work for ourselves. Each one of us has to run the bases of our life in our own unique way. What's required really is persistence and effort and not giving up. You know, most of the practice could be summed up with, you know, most of Dokusan could be summed up with carry on. Carry on. Just carry on. And this is a practice of carrying on. Carrying on the activity of looking, learning, exploring, finding for ourselves. And as for human beings that we are, it's been found to be effective to do this for long hours, right? It's like we really need that session is set up in a certain way in order to make us stretch, in order to like raise the temperature, to apply the pressure. So that through concentration and through focused effort, the deeper work of transformation, the deeper realization can have the best conditions possible in its favor in order for that to take place. And then we have the talks, of course, you know, in some places they don't do that. Antanji with Shohaku Okamura's teacher, Uchiyama Roshi, Okamura's teachers, his temple in Japan, they don't, in session, they won't have Dharma talks or Dokusan. It's just sitting all the way through, where he would call no toys, no toys approach. Right? There's always somebody out there sitting a stronger session, you know? There's always somebody out there getting up earlier, or struggling mightier, more mightily, right? But we're here, and this is our session. This is the practice that we're engaged in with a schedule that we have. But we're all engaged in the same effort to realize what Manjushri calls here the Dharma King's Dharma. The Dharma King's Dharma. And so he introduces the Buddha in somewhat dramatic fashion here. Right, it's like seeing, you know, if ever I was looking with my son, it's like my son's home from college and usually go see a couple of the big movies in the summer that come out. You know, it's something we've always done together since he was small. So you see the trailers now coming out for the summer movies. You get the trailer and you're like, oh yeah, looking forward to that one. You know, and think about when you might be able to go see it in a couple of weeks. You know, in something of the same way, Manjushri, like, here's the trailer. You know, he unveils the trailer here and says, when you realize the Dharma King's Dharma, the Dharma King's Dharma is just as is. And everyone's waiting. And here comes the Buddha. And the sounding post is struck. And the Buddha descends from the platform. And leaves. Would you be disappointed in that? I mean, what can the Buddha really say, though, at that point? Manjushri says it all. In one, say it three times fast sentence. When you realize the Dharma King's Dharma, the Dharma King's Dharma is just as is. This is our practice. This is the heart of Zazen. This perhaps is why Tendai Wanchi, who is a great luminary of the Soto school, puts this first in a book of 100 cases where he knowingly wanders in now to muddy the waters, perhaps. Right? But in the first case, it just says, when you realize it, then it's just as is. And if we haven't yet grasped the truth or understood the truth of that statement, 99 more cases will help elucidate this. But right from the beginning, he says, when you realize it, it is just as is. In the preface, close the gate and snooze, that's how to treat a superior person. But reflection, abbreviation, elaboration, everything, all these other methods are used for middling and inferior ones. Yeah, I would confess to being somewhere in the middle in an inferior camp. In that sense, right? Don't we all enter the practice as beginners, trying to find our way, trying to find our way in session, trying to better understand? And for most, right? I guess for all, it is a difficult, and the path unfolds in ways that cannot be known. The path unfolds in a unique manner for each one. But the way to the path, the opening of the gate, is always this just as is. It's always this now. Which can easily become such a cliche in Zen. Just as is. Or just this. You know, you say that, and it can be poison for the wrong ears. To say it is just as is. He adds for words Manjushri, when you realize it, it is just as is. Before you realize it, those words don't land. But our practice, you know, Zazen clearly lies at the heart of what we do. We come in, each one of us, arrange the body, and sit down, and then the bell is struck. Early in our practice, or maybe late in our practice, we may be using a meditation technique. These techniques are very old. I read a reference in the other book of Serenity, in the other translation, to the practice of counting to 10. I'm like, oh wow, they were talking about that then. I thought maybe that came in later. Nope, the practice of counting to 10 was like a well-worn practice a couple of thousand years ago. You know, we have the technique, counting, following, feeling the body, whatever, you know, whatever this approach to meditation. But Zazen is not meditation. It looks like meditation from the outside. You look around and people seem to be engaged in meditation. But meditation is involved is a practice and an approach and some method. The Dharma King's Dharma, just as is both before and beyond method. Never lacking, never obscured, always available, easily missed. Do we realize that? Is that realized? Is that realized now? Often in sitting, we can fall into the pit of the narrative, the personal, the me-I narrative of being the most pernicious of all. Somehow that I-me that likes to comment on the world and on the circumstances and everything that's going on. Right? That one continues to play. I don't know, maybe for you that one turned off on Tuesday and you've just been sitting in a somatic bliss for several days of no thought and no problem. Sit here all day. But usually, for most people, that story, that commentary, continues, right? And sometimes it's taken as that is, you know, we look at that and this is where some subtlety comes in. Is that actually a problem or not? Is that a problem or not? Often people, we take it as a problem. I've been sitting for days, I've been practicing for years and still I've got all of these thoughts going on. I've still got all of this dissatisfaction. I'm not doing it right. I'm missing something. He's getting it over there, I'm not getting it. You know, what's wrong with me? Right? But the issue is not the me-I construction of that narrative continuing, whether that's like, you know, whether that's occurring or not. What's important is what is your identification or attachment to that narrative and that idea, that unfolding of me-I. Because me, I, is always commenting on the world, commenting on me and the people in it, trying to safely navigate it and stay alive and prosper. That's like really hardwired into our very genetics. If you sit here and you, well, okay, I've been told, look at the room, notice the people, don't worry about thoughts. Wait, this is super boring. Nothing is happening in the room. They're all just, right? It's like we come up against this obstacle, perhaps, of the way the brain perceives that says, this is neither a threat or interesting. Therefore, cease involvement. And instead, turn and try to find something entertaining or threatening, doesn't matter. Negative or positive, doesn't matter. Something to chew on. Something to be involved in. This is like hardwired into the me I. If this is all very boring and there's nothing happening, well, let me think up some stuff that happened 10 years ago and see if, you know, I need to chew on, I can chew on that a little bit more. Right? But when we do that, when we just sort of reattach or cling to that, to our conditioning, cling to that story of myself and the world, then you just perpetuate those causes and conditions. And in fact, we're just feeding stuff into that. Feeding stuff into the machine. Adding and adding. Right? So Zazen, in this sense, is not adding. Not taking away. The human being is always immersed in attachment and aversion. From the first breath to the last. Always attached and always averse to things. That is the nature of, that is the human condition. This is where dukkha arises. The Dharma King's Dharma, just as is the essential practice of just sitting, directly experiencing the world, reality, whatever we erroneously name it, requires the dropping off of a letting go of attachment and aversion. But it is not dropping off and letting go of attachment and aversion to exchange the confused preferential state for the new, wonderfully vast, empty, luminous state. Right? That's just trying to trade up to better conditions. And we can fall for that in meditation or in practice. Things become quiet. Things become still. Things become, oh, this is better. This is better. But if it's still conditional, it's impermanent. Right? Often people will sit session and then go back to the world and it's just like, oh man, you know, now I lost it. I lost that samadhi, I lost that mind. Now I'm back in the to and the fro. Right? But it's something much deeper, much more immediate, which is not bound by this conditional. You know, Dogen talked about Zazen as unconstructedness in stillness. Dogen was an admirer and used the writings and the work of Tendo Wanchi in saying, not directly in the same lineage, but both in the Soto lineage. He would be in China not just a couple of decades or a few, somewhere around the time this was written. He was very much informed by this school, this what we call now the Soto school, right? This just sitting, this immediacy of experience, which is not bound up or attached to something conditional, whether it, you know, including it being quiet and concentrated. This is the great shift in Zazen, and then the extension of this shift in Zazen to all activities of day and night. The me, I, self is always involved in the karma of the world, is always rise and fall in the causes and conditions, picking and choosing, preferring and comparing. It's not that that one has to be extinguished or turned off. Who is the one who, when you sit, experiences and allows thought to unfold, to be as it is, to appear as it is? To appear as it is, just as the sound of a squirrel running across the roof of the Buddha hall appears, or the sunlight coming in the window, and yet finds no fault or particular interest in that stream of consciousness, that stream of thought. Who is it that can just allow that one, allow that to play, to unpack? But, you know, as a human being, often you can allow the more sort of banal chop of thinking about this and that, thinking about when the session's over, or what somebody said to me yesterday, or a vote, that can drop off. But then often the deeper patterns, the real deep entanglements of the way that we hold life, the deeper distortions, the way that we describe self, the ones that are deep down in the pit of the belly, you know, those are the ones that then starts to untangle. Those things come up. Right? And often that happens later in session. You start to really get to the nitty gritty, get down to something that's deeper. At this time in session, very important to really double down in terms of one's effort and single-pointed approach. Single-pointed approach in that when you come in for Zazen, just do Zazen, whatever your practice is. Sounds absurdly simple, but just do that through the entire block. Walk, just walk. Right, so that when you leave the Buddha hall, it's like leaving the gym after a hard workout, only, you know, spiritually. It's like because you've made great effort in here to be thus, to not fall for the siren call of story and narrative, an idea on placing yourself, how you're doing and where you're going and what this means. What can the Buddha say? He extraordinary in that he taught for so many years and did more than just, of course, give Dharma talks. I was reading that, again, the culture that he was in during the time. There was an enormous, like, there was a lot of sacrifice going on. You know, humans have, you know, in so many cultures, and it's just like, oh, here they are with a sacrifice. You know, it's like, like in those Vedic cultures of the time, they would sacrifice animals a lot, and sometimes hundreds or even thousands at a time for major festivals. And he was appalled by that. You think, well, just see like the heart, you know, of compassion at that time and the courage to go against that. To say, no, this life is involved in doing the least harm possible. This ahimsa, the qualities, you know, these qualities that he brings out in Buddhism, to courageously say that, and yet that doesn't come from some ideas about life, but rather from his deep realization of life, of how things actually are. You know, as you see in, as we practice, you see how greed, anger, and ignorance arises in our own heart. It does for me over and over and over. You know, somebody was telling me some time ago and they confessed to really hating somebody. And I just said, oh, you know who I really hate? And they were like, what? Like, thinking he must be beyond that at this point, right? Practiced so many years, got the brown robe, doesn't hate things. Oh no, I hate things. Like, because I'm a human being, right? We're all involved in those things, but it's like, do they run you? Do they run you? Do they distort you into committing the next negative action? Right? This heart of Zazen is so important because it's always the blank slate. It's always the fresh beginning. It's always coming back to neutral. coming back to the places just as is. The world is this way. This is your life. Maybe your one life, right? Who knows? We have all kinds of stories, even in Buddhism. This is what's going to happen after we die. Okay, maybe. Who knows? But by some curious churn of these causes and conditions, here you are. Here everyone is. And they're wonderful causes and conditions. Right? To think about like all the causes and conditions of the world, to be sat in an early May sunshine in California doing a Zen retreat, you won the lottery. Each of us has that responsibility then for like the causes and conditions that we are. Like, how do I then go forward? How do I live this life? How do I help unfold this life? It's not, in my experience, it's not so useful to spend a lot of time in the rearview mirror about why or how it went down. Right, looking back. The past is useful in some ways, of course. It helps with experience and to inform the present. But as I'm sure you've noticed by now, in Zen, there is a heavy emphasis on the present, the present experience. Right? But this present experience that includes the past and includes future. But when you look to the past, there's no life there. The life is now. And when you look out to the future, there's no life there. The life, it's now. So this heavy emphasis is here, now. And there's no escape from here, now. But this here, now, is the Dharma is extraordinarily generous in second chances. To say, okay, you screwed it up to this point. Okay, we've all screwed it up to... However, look now, here you are. This, all of this is here. The world is here, you're here. Everything worked out. Everything has worked out fantastically. It's beautifully woven together with warp and woof, as it says, right, to bring you to this point of realization now. This point of experience. But if you compare that realization now with one that you want, one that you can imagine, one that you yearn for, it won't match up. If you compare that to something in the future, it won't match up, or to somebody else's, or to some idea. It doesn't have to be explained. It doesn't have to be grasped, even intellectually, this realization. But really, particularly again, at this point in session, just pour yourself and dissolve yourself into the real. And allow and accept it all. To be just as is. All of the content, all of the causes and conditions, all at once. Welcomed in. And as soon as you reach in there and just say, yeah, but what about this? Then it collapses. That's the hair's breadth difference between heaven and earth. In the verse he says, do you see the true manner of the primal stage? This is what I'm clumsily, you know, my own way, trying to point to. It's like, and ask that question. Do you see the true manner of the primal stage? This is the primal stage. Spoiler alert, right? This is the primal stage. Do you see the true manner of it? And if you're like, well, and then the ideas and opinions around the true manner of the primal stage or our mistaken views of what the Dharma means fill in, then we don't. Mother Nature goes on weaving, warp and woof, right? It's like the vertical and the horizontal. Mother Nature is just, and look all around. Spend some time outside. Maybe get a nap, if that's your predisposition in the afternoon. But then I encourage, like, spend some time and just look outside. Look at the trees, look at the sky, look at the mountains. That remain completely undisturbed by our current causes and conditions. Just Mother Nature just goes on weaving. Now it's spring. Nothing can be done about the spring gods outflowing or Manjushri's outflowing. I looked up to try and find a reference to him as a spring god. Apparently, in Nepal, Manjushri is credited with, there was a valley, looked like a great valley to live. The only problem was it was had a lake in the center. And Manjushri kindly put his sword through the mountain and drained the lake. Right? Probably an earthquake. Whether you call it Manjushri or not. And then it drained out and it left this beautiful, fertile plain. You know, so that was the reference that I found there. But it says, like, nothing can be done about Manjushri's outflowing, or somewhere it says, nothing can be done about his leaking. Whether you could say leaking or outflowing. Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, is exactly Manjushri. Has to be Manjushri. He can't help himself. He just completely has to be Manjushri. He just can't get up and just hit the block and sit down. Right? He says, for Dharmaki, he is the bodhisattva of wisdom. He has to say to everybody, here it is, in a sentence. This is wisdom. He can't be anybody but Manjushri. And each one of us, you can't be anyone else than who you are. And that's hard when you put that out in the world. And I would do that often with, you know, having difficulties with people. And it's like, they can't be anyone else than who they are. And I'm just like, oh, but they should be. They really should be different than what they are. But they're not. Manjushri is exactly Manjushri. Nothing can be done about it. Nothing can be done about you. You have to be exactly who you are. But that's wonderful. That, what a wonderful, there's so much freedom, and it's an invitation in that. To really swallow down whole and be exactly who you are. But we have to be careful with that. Because if, don't be who you think you are. Right? We have that one who, I think I know who I am. And I think I know who they are. It's always wrong. It's always partial. It's always incomplete. It's always a story. The one who you are is just as is, without name, without history, without definition. That is the one that we realize. Have that one be real. And then this unfolding of me, I, and people in the world. Sure, that one, that is not forgotten. But our dealings with the world can be tempered and informed by this non-attachment to these causes and conditions, preferences. You know, we learn that great shift of letting go of preferences and a value system that our mind imposes on reality. Drop that off in Zazen. Make it real in our lived activities. And then it's apparent, it's there. You see it. In the midst of picking and choosing, there is also no picking, no choosing. Right? That possibility is remains open. In dealing with self and other, we understand it's always partial. The opposite is also true. It's never complete. It's such a powerful practice, this practice of Zen, the practice of Zazen, this long history of tradition, of meditation, of looking into our nature in order to find the truth of it. Not a truth that can be grasped or known, not that I found the truth, and then, you know, write it down. It can't be known in that way. It's this unfolding truth that's always now and always one step in front. again, genuine gratitude for your efforts. I reflect on the sessions that I've done here and the few that I did before that I came here, and many have been very tough. I never look forward to session. I don't think, oh, session's coming on Sunday. Can't wait. You know, usually I go in with a sense of dread. You know, just, oh no, I've got to do so. Here we go, session. Because I know it's difficult for me. For me. But in the other sense, it's not difficult at all. There's no difficulty here. There's no problem here. There's no problem here. So please, let's continue to do our best. It benefits each of us, and it benefits those in our sphere of activity. You know, as I'm like fond of pointing out, it's you could have the worst session ever in history, back to Tendo Wanshi, worst session experience ever. But the fact that you're sitting there and showing up and practicing, that supports me. It supports the people to your left and right. It supports the person opposite you. And who knows, maybe someone hears the next Dogen. It'll reach tens of thousands or millions of people. So it's not just about, it's not about this one. It's about this one. It's this collective endeavor. It really is, for the benefit of all. So thank you for making such effort.